McGraw-Hill Ascent Audio presents The McKinsey Way by Ethan M. Raziel. Narrated by Michael Butler Murray. Publisher's note. In this audio edition, you will hear references to figures present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Introduction. Think of this book as a sampler. You, the listener, need not start at the beginning and work your way through to the end. If you want to, feel free. About McKinsey. To provide some background for those of you unfamiliar with McKinsey & Company, I offer a few words about the organization that its members past and present refer to as the firm. Since its founding in 1923, McKinsey & Company has become the world's most successful strategic consulting firm. It currently has 75 offices, and counting, around the world, and employs some 4,500 professionals. It may not be the largest strategy firm in the world, some of the big accounting firms have larger practices, but it is certainly the most prestigious. McKinsey consults to most of the Fortune 100, as well as to many U.S. state and federal agencies and foreign governments. McKinsey is a brand name in international business circles. Several senior McKinsey partners have risen to international prominence in their own right. Lowell Bryan advised the Senate Banking Committee during the savings and loan crisis. Kenichi Omai, who recently left the firm, writes books on management and futurology that are bestsellers in Japan. Herb Hensler advised former German Chancellor Helmut Kohl on business and economic matters. Even more visible are some of McKinsey's alumni, who have gone on to senior positions around the world. Tom Peters, management guru and co-author of In Search of Excellence. Harvey Gulub, president of American Express. And Adair Turner, president of the Confederation of British Industries, to name but three. To maintain its preeminent position and to earn its high fees, the firm seeks out the cream of each year's crop of business school graduates. It lures them with high salaries, the prospect of a rapid rise through McKinsey's meritocratic hierarchy, and the chance to mingle with the elite of the business world. In return, the firm demands total devotion to client service, submission to a grueling schedule that can include weeks or months away from home and family, and only the highest quality work. For those who meet McKinsey standards, promotion can be rapid. Those who fall short soon find themselves at the latter end of the firm's strict policy of up or out. Like any strong organization, the firm has a powerful corporate culture based on shared values and common experiences. Every McKinseyite goes through the same rigorous training programs and suffers through the same long nights in the office. To outsiders, this can make the firm seem monolithic and forbidding. One recent book on management consulting likened McKinsey to the Jesuits. In truth, as I hope this book will communicate, McKinsey is as human as its employees are. The firm has its own jargon, too. It is full of acronyms. EM, ED, DCS, ITP, ELT, BPR, and so forth. McKinseyites call their assignments or projects engagements. On an engagement, a McKinsey team will search for the key drivers in their quest to add value. Like most jargon, much of this is simply verbal shorthand. Some of it, however, once understood, can be as useful to business people outside the firm as it is to McKinseyites themselves. In sum, like any powerful organization, McKinsey is complex. I hope this book will lift at least a corner of the veil of the McKinsey mystique and allow you, the listener, a peek into the inner workings of a very successful company. About this book. I have divided this book into five parts. In the first three, I explain how McKinseyites think about business problems and how they work at solving them. Parts 1 through 3 are the meat of the book, and I hope that you will find in them something new to help you in your business career. In part 4, I give some lessons McKinseyites have learned for coping with the stresses of life at the firm. Anyone who works hard in today's business world should learn something useful, or at least amusing, there. Finally, Part 5 briefly recounts some lessons learned at the firm and shares a few memories of McKinsey. I wrote this book with the goal of communicating new and useful skills to everyone who wants to be more efficient and effective in business. Anyone who wants to learn proven methods for approaching business problems in a structured, fact-based way will find them in these chapters. And anyone looking for survival tips in the jungle of today's business world can benefit from doing things the McKinsey way. In addition, this book will give any executive who works with management consultants, whether from McKinsey or elsewhere, some insight into how these strange beings think. Although each consulting firm has, or at least claims to have, its own methods, the root of all management consulting is the application of objective analysis by dispassionate outsiders. Other firms may not do things the McKinsey way, but their consultants' minds work in similar ways to McKinseyites. Forewarned is forearmed. I based this book on my own experience as a McKinsey associate from 1989 to 1992. I learned an enormous amount in that time, but scarcely enough for me to explain to the world the skills that McKinseyites use to succeed. Fortunately, I had help. I interviewed dozens of former associates, engagement managers, and partners of the firm. Their knowledge and the lessons they learned during their time at McKinsey helped fill the many gaps in my own knowledge. About clients. The word client appears in almost every chapter of this book. Since I'm writing from the McKinsey perspective, I use client to mean the organization for which you are solving a business problem. If you are not a consultant of some form, then strictly speaking, when you are working on a business problem, you don't have a client. I'd like to put it another way. You or your organization are your own client. Seen that way, the term client becomes applicable to any organization in which you work, whether as outsider or insider. In addition, I believe that thinking about your own organization as your client does make it easier to take advantage of the techniques in this book. One of the cardinal virtues within McKinsey is confidentiality. The firm guards its secrets closely. I, along with every other former McKinseyite, agreed never to disclose confidential information about the firm and its clients, even after leaving McKinsey. I do not intend to break that agreement. Consequently, most of the names of companies and people in this book have been disguised. As I said at the beginning, this book can be listened to from start to finish, or dipped into, like a box of chocolates. Whichever way you choose, I hope you'll find something you like. The McKinsey Way. Part 1. The McKinsey Way of Thinking About Business Problems. McKinsey exists to solve business problems. The consultants who succeed at McKinsey love to solve problems. As one former EM put it, engagement manager. The EM is in charge of the day-to-day work of a McKinsey team. Problem solving isn't a thing you do at McKinsey. It's what you do at McKinsey. It's almost as though you approached everything looking for ways it could be better, whatever it was. A part of you is always asking, why is something done this way? Is this the best way it can be done? You have to be fundamentally skeptical about everything. Part 1 describes how McKinsey thinks about business problems. It shows what it means to be fact-based, structured, and hypothesis-driven. It will tell you the McKinsey way to approach a business problem and offer you a few choice rules to live by when trying to solve them. 1. Building the solution. Like all things McKinsey, the firm's problem-solving process has three major attributes. When team members meet for the first time to discuss their client's problem, they know that their solution will be fact-based, rigidly structured, hypothesis-driven. At McKinsey, 3 is a magic number. Things at the firm come in threes. Notice that this list has three items. Ask a McKinseyite a complex question, and you are likely to hear, "There are three reasons." Then, of course, as you will learn later in the book, there is the true McKinsey hierarchy for consultants. In descending order, client, firm, you. In this chapter, you will learn exactly what these attributes mean and how you can apply them in your business. Facts are friendly. Facts are the bricks with which you will lay a path to your solution and build pillars to support it. Don't fear the facts. Problem solving at the firm begins with facts. On the first day of an engagement, all members of the team comb through stacks of articles and internal research documents to gather enough facts to illuminate their piece of the problem for the first team meeting. Having drawn up an initial hypothesis for the problem, the team then races to gather the facts necessary, when put through the appropriate analyses, to support or refute it. At the start of your time at McKinsey, gathering and analyzing facts is your raison d'être. As one former SEM observed, Senior Engagement Manager. In many ways a junior partner, the SEM is in charge of multiple studies and is expected to take a hand in client relations. SEMs get all the stress of partnership with less pay. When you strip away a lot of the high-minded language with which McKinsey dresses up its problem-solving process, it comes down to very careful, high-quality analysis of the components of the problem, combined with an aggressive attitude toward fact-gathering. Why are facts so important to the way McKinsey does business? There are two reasons. First, facts compensate for lack of gut instinct. Most McKinseyites are generalists. They know a little about a lot of things. As they gain experience and move through the ranks, they may come to know a lot about a lot of things. Even at this point, however, they will still know less about, say, inventory management practices for perishable foodstuffs than the folks who have been running the distribution operations of Stop and Shop for the last 10 years. Gut instinct might tell those folks the solution to an inventory management problem in 10 seconds, although they still would be wise to check the facts. McKinsey will go to the facts first. Second, facts bridge the credibility gap. When she joins the firm, the typical associate, at least in the United States, will have graduated near the top of her college class, spent 2 or 3 years working for a large company, then received her MBA from a top business school. Associate, an entry-level McKinsey consultant, usually with an MBA. Technically, every consultant who has not made partner, even the hottest SEM, is still an associate of the firm. She will be in her mid to late 20s. On her first engagement, she may have to present her analysis to the CEO of a Fortune 50 company, who will not give much credence to what some newly minted 27-year-old MBA has to say, unless she has an overwhelming weight of facts to back her up. This is just as true for a junior executive presenting a proposal to his boss. Despite, or possibly because of, the power of facts, many business people fear them. Perhaps they are afraid that if they look too closely at the facts, they or someone above them might not like what they see. Maybe they think that if they don't look, the nasty facts will go away. But they won't. Hiding from the facts is a prescription for failure. Eventually, truth will out. You must not fear the facts. Hunt for them. Use them, but don't fear them. Feel free to be messy. To structure your thinking when solving business problems, or anything for that matter, you must be complete while avoiding confusion and overlap. M-E-C-E, pronounced messy, stands for mutually exclusive, collectively exhaustive, and it is a sine qua non of the problem-solving process at McKinsey. MISI gets pounded into every new associate's head from the moment of entering the firm. Every document, including internal memos, every presentation, every email and voicemail produced by a McKinseyite is supposed to be MISI. Ask any member of McKinsey alumni what they remember most about the way the firm solves problems, and they will tell you. Misi, Misi, Misi. Misi structures your thinking with maximum clarity, hence minimum confusion, and maximum completeness. Misi starts at the top level of your solution, the list of issues making up the problem you have to solve. When you think you have determined the issues, take a hard look at them. Is each one a separate and distinct issue? If so, then your issue list is mutually exclusive. Does every aspect of the problem come under one, and only one, of these issues? That is, have you thought of everything? If so, then your issues are collectively exhaustive. Suppose your team is working on a study for the famous American manufacturing firm Acme Widgets. The problem you face is, we need to sell more widgets. Your team might come up with a list of the following ways to increase widget sales. Changing the way we sell our widgets to retail outlets. Improving the way we market our widgets to consumers. Reducing the unit cost of our widgets. If this list looks rather generic, that's fine. We will talk about moving down a level of detail in the next section. What matters is that the list is Misi. Suppose you add another item, say, re-engineering our widget production process. How does that fit with the three issues you already have? This is certainly an important issue, but it isn't a fourth point alongside the others. It falls under reducing the unit cost, along with other sub-issues, such as leveraging our distribution system and improving our inventory management. Why? Because all these are ways to reduce the unit cost of widgets. Putting any, or all of them, with the other three issues on the list would cause an overlap. The items in the list would no longer be mutually exclusive. Overlap represents muddled thinking by the writer and leads to confusion for the reader. Once you have a list in which all the items are separate and distinct, that is, mutually exclusive, you have to check that it also includes every issue or item relevant to the problem. That is, it is collectively exhaustive. Go back for a moment to re-engineering our widget production process. You put this under reducing the unit cost. Now, one of your team members says, we should think about ways to improve widget quality through the production process. She's right. Does this mean you should go back to having re-engineering as an issue in its own right? No, but you should refine your list to include under reducing unit cost, the sub-issue, re-engineering the production process to reduce unit cost, and under improving the way we market, the sub-issue, re-engineering the production process to improve widget quality. Now you have something that looks like this. Changing the way we sell our widgets to retail outlets. Improving the way we market our widgets to consumers. Re-engineering the production process to improve widget quality. Reducing the unit cost of our widgets. Re-engineering the production process to reduce unit cost. Suppose your team has come up with some interesting ideas that don't fit under the main issues. What then? You could ignore those points, but that wouldn't help Acme. You could make them issues in their own right, but then you would have too many issues. A good McKinsey issue list contains neither fewer than two nor more than five top-line issues. Of course, three is best. There is a solution to this dilemma, the magical category, other issues. If you can't figure out where to put those two or three brilliant ideas, there is always other issues. There is a caveat, however. Avoid using other issues in your top-line list. It looks out of place. It's fine lumped in among a bunch of sub-issues. But on the first slide of a big presentation, it sticks out. So try a little harder to fit those brilliant ideas into your top-line issues. Chances are you can. Still, if all else fails, other issues will help you stay Misi. Solve the problem at the first meeting. The initial hypothesis. Solving a complex problem is like embarking on a long journey. The initial hypothesis is your problem-solving map. The initial hypothesis, IH, the third pillar of the McKinsey problem-solving process, is the most difficult to explain. To make the explanation easier for you and me, I will break this section into three parts. Defining the initial hypothesis, generating the initial hypothesis, testing the initial hypothesis. Defining the initial hypothesis. The essence of the initial hypothesis is, figure out the solution to the problem before you start. This seems counterintuitive, yet you do it all the time. Suppose you have to drive to a restaurant in a part of town you don't know. You know you have to make the third left off Smith Street and then take the first right. It's just after that corner. You know how to get to Smith Street. You'll just follow your directions from there. Congratulations! You have an initial hypothesis. Solving business problems is more complicated than finding a restaurant. But the initial hypothesis works the same way. It is a roadmap, albeit hastily sketched, to take you from problem to solution. If your IH is correct, then solving the problem means filling in the details of the map through factual analysis. Let's return to Acme widgets from the last section. You and your team must find a way to increase sales at the widget business unit. After you've brainstormed using your knowledge of the widget business, but before you've spent a lot of time gathering and analyzing the facts, you might come up with the following top-line IH. We can increase widget sales by changing the way we sell our widgets to retail outlets, improving the way we market our widgets to consumers, reducing the unit cost of our widgets. As I will show in the next section, you would then take each issue down to another level or two of detail to determine which analyses you need in order to prove or disprove each hypothesis. Remember that a hypothesis is merely a theory to be proved or disproved. It is not the answer. If your IH is correct, then, a few months down the road, it will be the first slide in your presentation. If it turns out to be wrong, then by proving it wrong, you will have enough information to move toward the right answer. By putting your IH down on paper and determining how you can prove or disprove it, you have set up a roadmap that you can follow to an eventual proved solution. Generating the initial hypothesis. The IH emerges from the combination of facts and structure. Therefore, as the first step in generating an IH, you must start with the facts. Remember, however, that you don't want to do a lot of digging around for information before you know where to dig. One former McKinsey SEM had a good approach for generating IHs. At the start of an engagement, I would just try to digest as much of our fact base as possible. I would sit down with the trade publications in that industry for an hour or two, not so much to gather facts as to absorb something of the flavor of that industry, what the jargon is, what the current industry issues are. I would especially seek out people in the firm who knew about this particular industry. That was the quickest, most efficient way to get up to speed. When generating an initial hypothesis, you don't need all the facts, just enough to have a good overview of the industry and the problem. If the problem is in your own business, you may already have the facts in your head. That's great, but facts are not enough. You have to apply structure to them. To structure your IH, begin by breaking the problem into its components, the key drivers. Next, make an actionable recommendation regarding each driver. This is extremely important. Suppose your business's profits are greatly affected by the weather. In fact, it is the key determinant of profits in a given quarter. "We have to pray for good weather," is not an actionable recommendation. On the other hand, "We must reduce our vulnerability to changes in the weather," is an actionable top-line recommendation. For your next step, you must take each top-line recommendation and break it down to the level of issues. If a given recommendation is correct, what issues does it raise? Consider the likely answers to each issue. Then go down another level. For each issue, what analyses would you need to make to prove or disprove your hypothesis? With a little experience and a lot of debate within your team, you should get a good sense of what is provable and what is not. This will help you avoid blind alleys. In the Acme widgets problem, suppose your team decided that the key drivers were the sales force, the consumer marketing strategy, and production costs. You then came up with a list of actionable top-line recommendations as your initial hypothesis. We can increase widget sales by changing the way we sell our widgets to retail outlets, improving the way we market our widgets to consumers, reducing the unit cost of our widgets. Let's begin with a closer look at the sales force. It's organized geographically, Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, Southeast, etc., and sells primarily to three types of retail outlets: superstores, department stores, and specialty stores. The team believes that the sales force ought to be organized by customer type. That's one issue. What analyses could prove or disprove that belief? You could break out the sales by customer type for each region. If penetration of superstores in the Northeast is higher than in any other region, and higher than for the other types of retail outlets, find out why. When you talk to the Northeast sales reps, you might find that they have a better feel for superstores than any other sales team. What if they were put in charge of all superstores across the country and achieved the same penetration? What would that mean for widget sales? The end product of this exercise is what McKinsey calls the issue tree. In other words, you start with your initial hypothesis and branch out at each issue. When you've completed your issue tree, you have your problem-solving map. That's the easy part. The difficult part will come when you have to dig deep to prove your hypothesis. Issue tree for Acme widgets. Increase widget sales. Change sales strategy. Salesforce organization, Salesforce skill base, promotion strategy. Improve marketing strategy. Product quality, packaging, consumer advertising strategy. Reduce unit cost. Raw materials sourcing, production process, distribution system. Testing the initial hypothesis. Before you take your problem-solving map out on the road, you want, forgive the mixed metaphor, to kick the tires on it. Test it. Is it the best possible hypothesis you could devise, given what you know about the industry and your client or company? Have you thought about all the issues? Have you considered all the drivers of the problem? Are all your recommendations actionable and provable? When I discussed generating an IH, I used the phrase your team rather than you. My experience at the firm, and that of the many McKinsey alumni I interviewed for this book, taught me that IHs produced by teams are much stronger than those produced by individuals. Why? Most of us are poor critics of our own thinking. We need others to pick apart our ideas. A team of three or four bright individuals is an excellent vehicle for that. So when your team meets to come up with an IH, let a thousand flowers bloom. Everyone should have his or her own ideas and initial hypotheses. Everyone should be prepared to push a teammate's thinking and test each new idea. If you are the team leader, you should try to be the thought leader, too. Try to take a different approach from whatever has just been said. Ask, what if we change this? What if we push that? How about looking at it this way? The process involves shooting a certain amount of bull. That's okay. Have fun, as long as it pushes your thinking. 2. Developing an approach. Just knowing the essence of the McKinsey problem-solving process does not mean you can go forth and conquer the business world by being fact-based, structured, and hypothesis-driven. No two business problems are identical. You must figure out how to approach each problem in order to devise the best solution for it. In this chapter, I will explain how McKinseyites approach business problems and apply the McKinsey problem-solving process to maximum effect. The problem is not always the problem. Sometimes a business problem will land on your desk and you will be able to solve it. Fair enough. But before you go rushing off in any particular direction, make sure you're solving the right problem. It may not be the one you were given.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?